Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, historians, and authors, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Michael Brown. He is a teacher, a researcher of Scottish history at the University of St. Andrews, and he's written multiple historical books, including today's book, which is The Wars of Scotland, 1214 to 1371. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So there is something very magical about the 13th century. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. So I'm really excited to have you here. Okay. So this book, The Wars of Scotland, part of the book obviously takes place, or a large part of it takes place in the 13th century in Scotland. Can you tell us around that time, what was Alba? What was Scotland? What's the difference?
I mean, it's a language difference. Alba is the Gaelic name for Scotland. It was then, okay. It is now. And Scotland is the name from English. And you had English-speaking and Gaelic-speaking populations in Scotland then, as you do now, though the balance was much, much closer. So it's just the same place, different language.
When was the transition over to, like, we're not calling it Alba anymore, now everyone's calling it Scotland? When did that happen?
I mean, that's about language change more generally, and that takes place over centuries. So around, say, 1100, then Ooh. Gaelic was spoken all over Scotland north of the Forth, so north of Edinburgh and Glasgow upwards. That was a Gaelic-speaking area. And gradually, during the next 400 years, then Gaelic is supplanted by English, I think, from the kind of coastal regions, particularly because you're having English populations, English-speaking populations, settling or arriving in the new towns along that area. So
yeah.
English becomes the language of trade. It's a useful skill. Gaelic remains spoken at home in rural areas, really into the 16th, 17th century in a lot of the eastern lowlands. But it's a kind of bilingual society. So it's a slow language shift, and English becomes the language of the law and government in
right.
the late Middle Ages, so 15th, 16th century.
Interesting. Okay, so that it's very similar to the Normans conquering England, where, you know, everything turned into French, and the court and the laws, and everybody spoke French, and eventually our language was Frenchified and Latinized. And so that's interesting.
Though interestingly, English reasserts itself in the late medieval period.
Yeah, that is interesting. Okay, so I wanted to ask too, around that time, how, let's say the 13th century, how much of the population do you think spoke English?
I mean, we don't really have ways of assessing what the population is at all for Scotland. So guesses range from 500,000 to 1,000,000. So a huge range in terms of
that's
numbers.
Pretty big.
But I mean, even in the early modern period, so from around 1600, when you can start to make more accurate assessments of population, probably half the population lives in the Highlands. And is primarily Gaelic speaking. So late as that. So
half the population.
I mean, the Highlands is a big area.
Yeah.
But the Lowlands is more sparsely populated. It's before industrialization. It's before the big cities.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And I wanted to ask, too, so you talk about we're spanning the 13th and the 14th century in this book. And instead of splitting it up into like this hard line of the 13th century, the 14th century, it's kind of this overarching story. And that is that because it just kind of really nicely encompasses the wars of independence?
Yes, I think so. Quite often you have books that have gone up to the wars and then stopped or has dealt with the wars and gone on. You know, so the wars are this great, they are a great transition, they are a great dividing point in many ways. But looking at the whole period, you get a sense of what continues and also what changes, and that balance between continuity and change as a result of what is initially at least a political crisis, but then gets caught up in a whole range of other issues.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And okay, so just round about, how many clans would you say kind of existed and got swallowed up in these wars? Was it like 500, you know?
That depends what you mean by a clan. So clan is the Gaelic word for family. I mean, obviously in Scotland and later in the Highlands, it has a very specific meaning of a family group which has land, which has an identity. If we're talking about the sort of landholding class, you're probably looking at, maybe two dozen great families, and then probably around 200 to 300 significant families who are local landowners.
That's probably more than I was picturing. I was picturing somewhere in that ballpark, but it's kind of hard to imagine. And it's also hard to remember that the population of the world was so small compared to how it is now, that was like a big deal having that many people.
And some of those families, I mean, we would think of them, they're not particularly wealthy, but they have lands which have legal rights to try criminals and to manage people that go with them. So they would think of themselves as lords. So even if they're not particularly wealthy or particularly prominent.
That's so funny, because I feel like I have this sense of Scotland and lords being more tied to land and wars and things like that than I do with lords in England, which are a little bit more removed, I think, a level.
Yes, I think there's some truth in that. I think what you do find in Scotland, which is different from England after the Norman Conquest, are bigger landed units. So in Scotland, there are earls, as in England, though the Gaelic word for those is mormaer, great stewards, who are prominent over a province. They have an area of the kingdom which they quite often have some kind of special authority. And that link between the great nobles and a particular region has been broken in England after the Norman Conquest. The kings don't want that kind of noble. Whereas in Scotland, probably rooted from quite a distant past, you still have people like the Earls of Fife or the Earls of Mar in the north, and the Earls of Lennox, around Loch Lomond. So those kind of figures still have a close relationship with their province. They lead the men of that province in war, and people feel a sense of identity with their provincial unit as well as with something bigger or something smaller.
That's interesting. Like, to see, I feel like that change where you're not really wanting your lords to be that involved in the military happened way earlier than in Scotland. And in Scotland, there's this feeling of it being more gruff, more tied to the land, more, you know, blood and iron, like, you know, that kind of thing. And so would they have competed? So these lords in Scotland, would they have been kind of on the same level as, let's say, like the marcher lords up in Scotland, England-Scotland border?
In the 13th century, the Anglo-Scottish border isn't particularly militarized. It's quite a peaceful frontier, and it's really a boundary between two different jurisdictions, if you like. So it gets that character of a military frontier because of the wars, because you have England and Scotland permanently at war.
There we go.
Where you have that equivalent of marcher lords, I mean, it's a model that is in the west and the north. So the Scottish kings in the 12th and in the 13th century have placed families that they regard as trustworthy in regions of the west, what later get called the Highlands. So areas where direct royal authority is quite difficult to enforce, so you put people on the spot.
Makes sense.
And they build castles, and they police those regions for the king. And, you know, the Hebrides, the Western Isles to the west of Scotland, they're only brought into the kingdom in 1266, so very late. And they're part of the Norwegian kingdom before that. And, you know, there is a war between the Scottish and Norwegian kings.
So fascinating.
Essentially bringing those islands ultimately under the Scottish king's rule. But his rule there is really nominal. The people essentially are running themselves. So, and they are the descendants of the Vikings. They're militarized. They have galley fleets. And to a degree, you need, you know, you need to manage those people. So having families who you can trust to kind of act in your place in that region is really useful.
That's interesting too, like where if you go on, let's say Ancestry DNA or something, and you see you have like all these ancestors like I do in Scotland, and you'll be like, oh, you've got Viking DNA, and you're, or like Norwegian DNA, and you're like it's all from like the Danelaw in Scotland, you know, like all that kind of stuff. So that's really interesting that it goes all the way back that far.
I mean, if you think about the geography, and you're sailing from Norway through Orkney and Shetland, which are really totally settled by Norwegians in the early medieval period, and you're heading down the Irish Sea to Ireland and then maybe to France and even the Mediterranean, then the Hebrides are on your route.
Yeah,
so
that's
true.
So there
is a lot of settlement there and intermingling with the pre-existing Gaelic-speaking population.
That's so cool. And so, okay, so if we're talking about these Scottish Wars of Independence, right? So what would you classify it as, more like this really long simmering tensions and issues, or kind of more like a flash boil before they exploded?
In terms of where they start from?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a sudden and relatively rapid descent towards war. So the relationship between England and Scotland during the 13th century has been mostly amicable. There are issues which cause tensions, but there's not really a separate war between England and Scotland during that century. Scottish kings do participate in conflicts within England, but they also hold lands in England, and so do many of their nobles. And
that's surprising.
English landowners hold estates in Scotland. And there's a lot of emphasis there from that group in avoiding conflict. You know, they don't want the relationship between these two kings to break down. It's a relationship which seems settled. What the fact that the Scottish king holds land in England means is that they have to perform homage for those properties to the English king. They are a vassal of the English king.
Sure.
And that allows a relationship to exist in which the English king is, if you like, the lord of the Scottish king, but that Scotland is not in that equation. So Scotland can be an independent kingdom, if you like, but at the same time, the relationship between the two men does have an element in which the English king can say, okay, well, I'm your superior. And the Scottish king says, yes, but not for Scotland. So that relationship works really well. And what breaks it down is a single random event, which is the death of King Alexander III in a riding accident, leaving behind him, in terms of his own family, a girl child who's a Norwegian princess. That's his only descendant living when he dies. And that kind of dynastic crisis is what's at root of the whole kind of rolling difficulties.
Again and again in the centuries all over Europe, king dies. Yeah, king dies, he's got a daughter, or maybe even son sometimes, and like it's still, you know, Wars of the Roses. You look at that and you're like, yeah. So that's not surprising that that would turn into war, especially in the Middle Ages. Oh my God. So when I'm, for instance, studying the 17th or 18th century, it's really, really, really hard to find. You can find sources, firsthand sources, but it's also kind of mishmashed and you're like, what? And, you know, so I was reading this book going, how did he find all these sources that must have been absolutely bonkers to wade through the firsthand accounts? Tell me all about that.
Well, I mean, I think the firsthand, if you like, the kind of personal witness of events as a story is almost impossible to find.
Yeah.
So what you're getting are historians writing from a distance and putting their own values and spin on events. So you've got to be quite cautious with those. But what you have, particularly from the English side, is a vast amount of record material. The English government, for a medieval kingdom, collects and preserves a huge volume of material, a lot of which they're producing, but also stuff that's being sent to them by other kings. So you're getting evidence from what's happening in Scotland in terms of warfare, very much more from the English side than the Scottish side. But they also report, they're also reporting about how the Scots are attacking them, for example, who's leading them,
okay,
what kind of methods they're using. So you have that kind of body of material, which is so valuable.
Was that really hard to determine, like, this guy obviously has a bias or is full of it, or, you know, how do you pick that apart?
Well, it depends what you're looking at. So, I mean, if it's simply castigating the Scots for their treachery or whatever, then, you know, you're in a world where it's fairly obvious what's going on. But if it's trying to understand why something has happened, and chroniclers, you know, they have a worldview, and they have a view of God's hand in the activities of man. But they are rational, and they're also thinking, well, you know, for example, about Bannockburn. How is it that we lost this battle at Bannockburn after we'd beaten the Scots in so many previous encounters? What has gone wrong? And partly you're saying, well, it's about morality, it's about behaviour. But also you're then saying, but it's also about the way the leaders operate. It's also about the fact that the march was too quick and the men were tired out when they got there. So they are trying to find sort of explanations for things. So
they're not off the deep end.
Yeah.
Like with okay. Now, on that note, are there any, one of my favorite medieval debates is King Richard and the princes in the towers and his reputation after he died, and where he was basically just trashed by the new king. Like, he lost the war, he sucks, he's terrible, and this is why I'm great. Are there any things like that in this 13th, 14th century Scotland that are just really debated? Like, maybe we see this totally wrong.
I mean, the thing about Scottish history, and it's a blessing and a curse, I think, is that it focuses on particular individuals. And I think probably everybody can think of who, you know, we're talking Mary, Queen of Scots, we're talking Bonnie, Prince Charlie.
That's true.
We're talking William Wallace, and we're talking Robert Bruce. And the debates, I think, such as they are, tend to sort of crystallize down onto the contributions that those two individuals make.
Okay.
And to a degree, you know, don't want to mention it too early, but Braveheart, we're probably aware of this as a thing. And Braveheart has within it that relationship between Wallace and Bruce. And even in the Middle Ages, you see writers starting to invent meetings between the two men, conversations between the two men, which actually are to a degree represented in that film. So the idea of Bruce and Wallace confronting each other after the Battle of Falkirk, and Wallace saying to Bruce, you should be leading the Scots. Why are you failing to perform this role for which you're born? And that tension, I suppose, between an individual who, in Scots' mind, after his lifetime, is born to be king, is the sort of destined king and the saviour of Scotland, and this figure who emerges from nowhere and actually provides the leadership at Scotland's darkest hour, is a conversation. And it binds into issues like, should we be led by the elite or should we be led by a popular figure? So those kind of political narratives from throughout history, from modern history.
That's a good question.
Sort of get boiled into that debate too.
That's fascinating. I would absolutely love to see people on opposite sides debating that question. That's really cool. I'm getting like goosebumps thinking about it. I don't know why this century in this area is like so magical and fascinating. I don't know why. But okay. One of the things you talk about in the book is this changing kind of internal character of Scotland. Can you tell us just a little bit about what readers can expect on that front?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the transition from the 13th to the 14th century across Europe is a deeply problematic and difficult one. In Scotland, you've got a society which has already been through a revolution and is still in the early 13th century going through that. So things like the formation of towns, a network of market towns and then trading towns on the coast, it's relatively new in Scotland. There aren't urban centres there before kind of 1120s. And they're still being founded in the 13th century, and Scotland's trade externally is growing. Kind of structures of government, again, are relatively new. The parishes with their churches. So Scotland is a new country in some ways. It's been remodeled. And the 13th century is a period of like the culmination of that, and of growing population and prosperity. And then you have this war. And this war changes that dynamic in some ways. It's an extremely traumatic and difficult period. And on political terms, it forces Scots to ask questions about who they are, what's important to them. The idea that their kingdom is embodied simply in the person of a king, or is the kingdom something that belongs to all of them and that they all have an obligation to defend, and a much wider group is involved in articulating its rights and what it means to be a Scot.
That's
so that
political
change, I think, is part of that. But it's also against the period, certainly by the time you get into the mid-14th century, for the latter part of the book, where you're getting climatic change. So you're getting a cooler, wetter climate, which in a region, you know, like of Europe, like Scotland, where your margins for growing cereal crops, for example, are already quite narrow. You know, these crops aren't, they have long gestation periods. So you need a big gap between the last frost in the spring and the first frost in the autumn. And in the 13th century, that's okay. In the 14th century, there are lots of marginal lands as you get higher in altitude where that doesn't work. So that economic climatic crisis, I think, changes the dynamic too. And why you get a shift towards herding, pastoral society, extending its reach around the highlands. And the sense of the highlands and Gaelic Scotland is starting to expand again in a way which people in the lowlands, English-speaking communities in the boroughs, church communities start to see as threatening and start to complain about to the government. So that shift is part of it too.
You know, I didn't really think about that too with, I think, so what the Little Ice Age, what we call the Little Ice Age, I think wasn't that the 1300s to the 1700s or something, where everything was just like a bit colder. And that's why you see everybody in all these heavy clothes all the time and then fireplaces all the time. And yeah, I didn't really think about the fact that some places like Scotland, way up there in, at the top of the globe, practically, you know, as far as land masses go, and you don't really have a lot of growing abilities, and how that would affect things. That's interesting.
You tend to shift towards herding animals.
Yeah, and that's so
grow
cool.
Grow crops that are better. You grow more oats and less wheat. You know, that kind of shift as well. So you're adapting. You know, that's what people are doing.
Or if you're England, you start colonizing other parts of the world.
Well, yeah, because of course the other thing that happens in this period is the plague.
Yes.
The plague, which causes, you know, massive reduction in population. And that actually weakens colonial flows. So people are leaving England to settle in Ireland and Wales, the 13th century, because there isn't enough land for the growing population to have access to. So you go west, just like in America in the 19th century. In Wales, for example, which is not that far from the areas of England that colonists are coming from, what the plague does is kills loads of people. But what you find is English peasants going out of Wales, going back to England and saying, you know, I can find land back in England. Yeah. I don't need to be in Wales, which is harsher, perhaps, climatically and environmentally. Yeah. And also you've got a lot of Welsh people who don't really like you very much living next door. So you get a kind of reverse colonization. I think those kind of people, I mean, they're harder to see in Scotland, but they're probably taking place. People are adapting, but also populations are moving.
Yeah. Did you ever see that movie Wagons East, where that comedy is like in the mid or late 90s? It's all these pioneers taking their wagons and going back east because they can't make it on the way. It's a really funny movie. But that's the joke, is that, like, that's why it's funny, because nobody does that. And so it was very rare. And so, but it happens. And, you know, I would definitely say that after the plague, especially the 14th century one, that was huge. Now you can make a living wage, too. There were competitive wages and things like that back in the old land. So that's interesting too. And I wanted to ask, so these wars back in the 13th, 14th century, how dispersed was the population? Like, could a large portion of the population be relatively unaffected by these wars?
That's a good question. It's quite hard to know. But what we do know is the nature of the war and the kind of warfare that's being waged is very often directed against those populations. So rural peasant populations, your troops are living off them. And they're demonstrating. So what Robert Bruce and William Wallace do, and to a degree what the English do in return, is demonstrate the inability of their opponents to protect people who are under their control. This isn't a war of pitched battles. This is a war of raids, campaigns, plundering attacks. And Robert Bruce in particular uses these tactics across Scotland. You know, areas of Scotland that are opposing him, he devastates to show that he can, really, and to make other areas think, we better recognise him, we better accept him as king, or he'll do this to us. So it is a war of terror. It's also a way of supplying your armies. And
so it spreads in that way, even people just being afraid of it.
Yeah. Okay. And how Bruce exercised, when he's got the ascendancy over the English after Bannockburn, he simply sends his armies into northern England, you know, twice or three times a year. They're doing these big marches into northern England, in a sense, daring the English to fight them in the open field, or demonstrating that they need to pay him money or he'll plunder their lands. And he's using that to make it worthwhile fighting for him. He doesn't have paid armies. They live off plunder.
Poor old England always being plundered and threatened.
After 20 years in Scotland, it's kind of that, I think.
England and Scotland, that's really funny. That definitely seemed to happen a lot for over the centuries in that time. People would come and they're like, we're going to rough you up unless you give us money and we'll go back home. And then people did give them money. And or the king, you know. And that's another debate I would love to see, is whether long term that was a good idea or not.
The Danegeld, you know? The buying off the Vikings kind of thing. Yeah, and they just come back for more. I suppose it's a temporary solution, isn't it? And maybe you hope things will be better next year.
Yeah, like, what do you get? Like, I would do the same thing, you know, like, honestly, I can criticize from centuries later now, but and was there any kind of dramatic kind of on the razor's edge with these wars that could have made things go differently? Let's say, like, if a battle had turned out differently, could history have changed?
Yeah, I mean, if we think about Robert Bruce, I mean, all the Scottish stories of Bruce from really quite early on, so probably during his own lifetime and certainly collected later in the 14th century, present Bruce's early attempts to make himself king as going disastrously wrong. He's a man on the run. He's a hunted outlaw in the woods. And you have all these stories about how he's confronted by groups of men who are trying to kill him. And also heroically, he kills them in return. At that point, if Robert is killed, then I think you may have a situation in which Edward I, the English king, has already conquered Scotland twice before Bruce claims the throne and starts a new war. So for a third defeat to be suffered, that might be it. It might not
that
be,
would
we
be
can't tell. But I think Bruce's death at that point changes things quite dramatically. And it's entirely possible
It would have changed things.
Four brothers and three of them are killed during that period.
Okay, so theoretically, could it have changed, let's say, King James uniting the kingdoms because he's the king in Scotland? Like, what if he never actually became king? Because, you know, like, it's just interesting to think of, like, what would have happened?
I mean, Edward I is working very hard and gets very close on a number of occasions to simply drawing Scotland in some form into his kingdom or into his dominions. And, you know, he's done that with Wales. I think in one sense, you can see he knows the means by which that might happen.
Yeah.
It just never quite sticks with Scotland for a variety of reasons. But that scenario is not incredible, I don't think. There's nothing fundamental that prevents that happening.
Yeah.
I think Scotland is more difficult to conquer and control than Wales for a number of reasons.
Yes.
But Edward comes quite close.
And I mean, maybe if his son, Edward II, hadn't been so Edward II, had been like actually a good king, and maybe things would have, I don't know, but maybe not. Because like you're saying, Scotland was very, very hard to control. So even with another Edward I, if his son had been like him, it was probably, I don't know if it would have changed.
No, I think it's one of those things where we can't know. But
I think
the other side is that by Edward I's last years, his subjects in England are so fed up with this war, they're so exhausted from supporting Edward's efforts to conquer Scotland. You know, there's been a war which has lasted for really 8 years by that stage, in which Edward is leading armies or trying to lead armies almost every year to Scotland. So people are tired of this war. And when it restarts in 1306, I think, you know, Edward I famously, of course, you know, he executes his prisoners. He takes prisoners who are churchmen, and he takes prisoners who are Bruce's female relatives, and he puts them in cages in castles. He's expressing, I think, his extreme exasperation with a war which just won't end. So Edward II, even if he'd been more like his father, I think, would have faced quite a lot of problems, because people were waiting for Edward I to die. He was a domineering figure. They didn't want to take on head first, so they're waiting for the new king, and then it's like, well, okay, the rules are changing now.
Like, screw this guy.
Partly that's Edward II being useless, but I think it's partly a reaction in any case.
Yeah. That's a really good explanation. Okay, yeah, because I think that makes a lot of sense. So it wouldn't have been that consequential if Edward II had been more like his father. That makes sense. Yeah, but like in the long run, like I think you're right, where it just like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Really, Scotland's not going
to
be conquered.
You need to be quite
right
a skillful politician as well as a military leader, I think, to have ridden that out.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I just had a few more questions here. Can you just tell us where the Stuarts fit into all of this?
Yeah. Well, the Stuarts are, at the beginning of the period, a great noble family. They're the, if you like, the hereditary stewards of the king, which is like an honor. It's not a real job. They don't hang around the king's household all the time. But it's an indication of their kind of dignity and status. And their lands are in the west, around the Firth of Clyde, so just to the west of Glasgow, you know, places like Arran and Southern Argyll. And their real importance through the wars is because of the marriage that takes place between Walter Stuart and Robert Bruce's daughter Marjorie. And that gives the family a connection to the royal line. Marjorie and Walter's son, who's named Robert after his grandfather, becomes the first Stuart king in 1371. And he's 55 by that stage, so he's quite old, middle-aged for 14th century standards. And he spent his life as a great nobleman, really expanding the Stuart standing across Scotland. So it's a story of kind of success.
Yeah.
Not in a particularly glamorous way. He's not a glamorous figure, Robert Stuart. He seems to be born by cesarean section or something like that. Something goes wrong with his birth. And his eyesight isn't good. He's called bleary-eyed. He seems, maybe he's premature, and therefore his eyesight hasn't formed properly. So he never comes across as this kind of heroic lead from the front kind of guy.
No, not at all.
I think he's quite a capable commander. He's more of a kind of crafty, skillful politician leader rather than a heroic figure like his grandfather. But he's the real architect of that family's power. And of course, what the Stuarts are really good at is getting that throne and then hanging on to it for generations, you know, and then getting another throne on the back of that.
So this is kind of like the birth of the Stuarts, the era of from whence they came, kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. All right. I want to ask, is there any, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but is there any kind of misconceptions about medieval Scotland that you would just love to correct?
It always slightly annoys me, and Scottish historians do this too, when you think about Scotland as a remote and backward somehow, because the medieval Scots were extremely keen to be seen as participating fully on a bigger stage. And that's partly because the country is not the richest, but equally it's because Scots, I think, see the importance of making connections beyond their country and bringing new ideas to their country. So you find Scottish traders and merchants all across Northern Europe, certainly in the 14th and 15th century, and probably in the 13th. It's just that we don't have that information. Berwick, now part of England, or realistically part of England, was the biggest Scottish borough. It had German and Flemish merchant communities in there in the 13th century as sort of permanent trading posts because of the volume of goods that were traded through Berwick to the continent. And Scottish wool was only in the great wool trade that we know about with England, with the Netherlands in the Middle Ages. Scotland's export trade was considerably smaller. It was about the sixth the size of England, but it was the net biggest supplier of wool to the Low Countries.
Really? I mean, I guess I can see that.
It's not a highly developed economy, but the Scots are part of these networks and are extremely conscious of that. So the idea that they're somehow remote, I think, is the thing that I was slightly annoyed by.
Yeah.
Because they're so keen not to be seen in that way.
Yeah, and I could say, so they're more important than they're given credit for. Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
that's
say that, but yeah.
That's cool. And I'm all for people giving more attention to Scotland and, you know, reading more books about Scotland and stuff. So, and my last question would be, if you could describe, let's say, 14th century Scotland in a few words that aren't war or independence, what would you, like, one or two words, what would you say?
I would say the essence of Scotland in many ways is that it's united but decentralized.
Ooh. So
the combination of a kingdom which has a developed sense of itself by the late 13th century.
Yeah.
And retains and strengthens that sense through the period of wars and crises, but also has within it considerable diversity of language, of law, of culture, which up to a certain point are seen as strengths. I think one of the things that starts to change and starts to become problematic is that sense of internal intolerance that develops in the late medieval period, particularly between Highland and Lowland Scotland.
Uh-huh, yeah, that's, I feel like that's still around today.
Yeah.
A bit. Okay, are you working on any other books after this?
So I've had a few out since then. But the book I've just finished writing and is off to the publishers is about Scotland and the Wars of the Roses. So it's looking at the role of Scotland in the complex politics of England and Ireland during the late 15th century, but also looking at Scotland's interconnections on a wider European stage, which I think are crucial to understanding the Wars of the Roses themselves.
I don't know anything about Scotland in the Wars of the Roses, so that is really cool. Okay, when do you think that'll come out?
Well, I don't know.
A year, 2 years?
Probably next year, I think.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to keep an eye out for that. That is really cool. So Michael Brown, author of The Wars of Scotland, 1214 to 1371, you can find it on Amazon, multiple bookselling websites, university bookselling websites, everywhere pretty much. So thank you again for joining us.
Lovely talking to you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye.